ॐ सहनागतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनापतितमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. That's pretty much a bhavana. Really, it's just what, how they deal with the pratipaksha bhavana in the shastras. It's very, very simple. Bhavana means, the word bhavana means an attitude or an emotion. Pratipaksha means the opposite. So pratipaksha bhavana means invoking the opposite attitude, the opposite emotion. That's what it is. So it's a very ancient, really, spiritual practice. And Shankara talks about it, I believe. So in the Pratipaksha Bhavana, Swamiji uses just the example, very simple example of for somebody who is causing you a reaction in your mind, hurting you, making you angry, whatever it is, causing discomfort. Then the Pratipaksha Bhavana is to either mentally or even physically to offer that person the equivalent of a flower. You know? You can use the flower just as an example to where every day you would actually offer that person a flower, either actually physically, you know, I'm offering you this flower every day because you accept me so much, or offering mentally that just that simple act of giving or openness or reaching out to the person. That's what they say about the Pratipaksha Bhavana. In fact, I've told the story before, but I remember in when I was at the ashram up near Garberville, you know, in Piercy, there was a person there that used to really really disturb me. It was just very difficult to be comfortable around that person. And so I used to talk to Swamiji about it because I was the manager there, and it was really a very difficult situation. And he said several times, I mean, I've learned one of the more important lessons in my life through this particular negative relationship. He said, just every day, every time you're around that person, you just make yourself do one positive act. Because that was it was really difficult. It was the type of thing where I would just avoid, like, the place. And even to make myself do a positive act, like, hi, how are you? Or how about just hi? And then scoot away. That's a positive act. That was very hard for me to do. But what I learned is that by doing that one simple positive act, whatever the negative block that was there would, for the time being, just dissipate. And so that was a huge lesson to me, because it was a really very difficult relationship, one that was causing me really a lot of stress, a lot of grief. And so I would avoid that person. But by doing that act, the avoidance, that's just on a physical level. You're avoiding because there's some psychological pain inside that's being generated by the difficulty of that relationship. So that one positive act somehow penetrates through, you know, the block. And so that's on a physical level. You can also do the same thing, just that simple act of offering something, on a mental, emotional level, and it's helpful. But what we're doing now is, and what Swamiji is doing now, is more complex and more effective, you know, in terms of working with working with dissipating the stress and tension that can be there in the difficult relationships we have in our life that don't just go away. I mean, there's some relationships where, you know, when the person at the store is rude to you. But you're never going to see that person again. It's not a problem. you know, you can say, you know, best wishes or whatever. Move on. Move on. But there are other situations where the person's part of your life. They're not going away. There's somebody that is integral to your life. You have to live with them. And that person is causing you some sort of a pain. That pain is what when we talk about antakarna shuddhi, that pain is the ashuddhi. You know, it's emotional pain that's the ashuddhi. Any amount of, just think about it really, any amount of busyness on the part of the mind, any amount of weird thoughts that are floating through, that doesn't make any difference. It's like riding on water. You know, it comes and goes. When Swamiji said, I've had so many, all kinds of funny thoughts. There's no ashuddhi there. It's scenery. It's just scenery passing through. It's not a problem. The ashuddhi, what we call the impurity, it's just impurity. Ashuddhi is, and what do they mean by impurity? There's something sullying the water, you know? There's something that's making me feel uncomfortable. You know, when we think of impurity, think of like a water bucket that somebody throws mud in, right? And then that water doesn't reflect the sun. And so it's not in a condition that's true to the sun. So we use examples like that. You know, and so there are things that happen that create ashuddhi in the mind, means emotional states, feelings that are uncomfortable, that are painful, that I want to get rid of, that I can't just sit with. Right? And so when there is such a state, it's usually, 99% of the time caused by a relationship with another person, usually. You know, it's usually not caused by nature. Once in a while it's caused by traffic, but those are things that can, you know, they'll come and go quickly. So it usually has to do with interpersonal relationships. Right? And so the problem with these interpersonal, with these personal relationships that we have, is that they stay with us inside. It's like you have a relationship with somebody, you say a long-term relationship with somebody, you have an exchange with them, that person goes on their way and you go your way, but you're carrying that person inside and that relationship inside. And so then you say you've had an altercation with this person, whatever it is, you're carrying that altercation with you, you know, hour after hour, even day after day. In fact, it can go month after month after month. You can feel the stress of that relationship, even if the person is on the other side of the world. They're still inside of you. Right? And so it's really important to learn different ways of breaking up the emotional knot that takes place inside, so that I don't have to walk around with it. The other person's long gone, but here I am day after day after day holding the stress inside. You know, that's what we mean by the ashuddhi. And you can say on one level, why does that ashuddhi take place in the first place? Why does that emotional baggage, that emotional pain takes place in the first place? You can go, well, it's because you don't have vairagya. I'm sorry. You don't have vairagya for that particular situation. And so that's really the cause. Well, that is also true. On one level, that's true. If the vairagya was there toward that person, this thing never would have happened in the first place. But the actuality is that for all of us, in many areas in our life, there isn't this vairagya where whatever you do is fine with me. That's just a reality. And so until I have that emotional freedom toward that person and that person and that person and all beings, until I have that emotional freedom, I need to know how to be with my mind. in a way that can release it, can release me. That's the thing. And so Pratipaksha Bhavana is one, just one of several ways that can be really useful. And it really has to do with just even on a private level, just within yourself, within your own mind, to first of all, allow yourself to embrace that situation between you and the other. Embrace it means to allow yourself to think about it and feel it. To really not push it away, to think about it and feel it and accept the reality of that situation. Joni, we did a meditation on this. You can listen to it later. So to be able to really sit with this, to actually feel it. And then notice that in this Pratipaksha Bhavana, I went to yourself first, dealing with yourself first. Because the child is hurt and you're angry, you're not in a position to go to the other person. It's really like in the airplane, you know, you put the mask on yourself first and then take care of your child. Because otherwise you're not going to be as emotionally available to even deal with the other person. And so just to ask you, the adult, in this meditative practice, to ask yourself, what is it that is really bothering me about this person? What is it that is really hurting? And don't hold back. Let yourself say all of the things that are upsetting you about this person, so that you know it's on the table to yourself. It's on the table. You're not holding back. And then you ask, the next thing we did, we didn't imagine on this level. The next thing we did was ask the inner child, go a little deeper, what is it that is really hurting? And you'll get more information, a different level of information. And let that part of you really tell everything, you know. And after you feel satisfied that you've been able to say all of these things, and you'll probably feel a lot of the stressful emotion also as you're doing that, because these are the things that are really hurting you and bothering you. And so as you're talking about it, those feelings will be there too, which is what we want. We want to be able to hold those feelings and not run away from them. It's then that, again, we still haven't gone to the partner in this particular dyad. It's then that you start using your imagination to transform that emotion, just on an imaginal level. Because the emotion and the imagination, they go together, you know? And so if you can ask the child, really, what would it take? Just imagine, how could this person be or behave towards you in such a way that you would feel better? And you imagine and work with that imagination until you start feeling better. That really will tell you a lot. It'll tell you what is actually necessary. What is it that child wants from this other person to relieve this pain? And so as you imagine it, actually, you often feel that pain dissipating by this new imagination. We're just, remember, just to be clear on this, the pain that we're holding is what we have introjected. The physical person is long gone. The physical you is long gone. The physical person is long gone in terms of whatever has happened to develop this tension. That's all past. But something is being held inside on an emotional and imaginal level. And so what I'm saying is, if you can let that child imagine, then not only has it said everything that is hurting it, it's also saying, giving you an image of what it would take, what it wants in order to free itself. And so then you will know. And then you can go to the adult part and do the same. Imagine what it would take. And then you'll have, in a way, just on your side, kind of a whole picture of the problem. What is hurting you, and what would it take to solve it? It's all on an imaginal level. That creates kind of a wholeness and a freedom inside. When you go now, having done that, when you go and do it for the other person, you know, what does that person want? What would it take? What do you think that person really wants? What would it take to make that person happy? That's really interesting.
Private.
Start doing from the other person, then all of a sudden a whole nother dimension, the other person becomes real too, and a person that has different needs and expectations. And then when you go to their child, that creates a whole different feeling. And then just, I haven't gone any farther now, just all we did in this meditation is then just to be able to hold that in consciousness. All I did at this point was to say, just to offer that whole thing to Ishwara, because in the sense that what we want is to come into some sort of a resolution, right? So it becomes a prayer to Ishwara. Right, this does. Well, we have further to go on this, and I'll do this another time. But Swamiji does this. But I some of you know, I'd asked him several years ago to Swamiji, you know, how do you pray? How do you pray? And I'm sure that's part two. Because so many people always ask Swamiji, including myself, to pray for, would you pray for this, would you pray for that? You know, and especially, you know, people bring really very big problems, also like life-threatening diseases and just everything imaginable. So I said, what do you do? How do you pray? And he thought about it for a minute, and he said, I imagine. I close my eyes and I imagine them, you know, as they would want to be. I imagine them as they would want to be. Like, say if the person is ill and trying to get well, and I'll imagine, I'm adding some words now, but just to flesh it out, I'm imagining them as well. Or if they have some economic crisis, I imagine that as being resolved. And then he offers that to Ishwara. That's what it is. And then I said, well, he said something like, I let that imagination come. I let that image come, something like that. I said, what if it doesn't come? You know? Because they're not going to get well, something like that, you know? And he said, if I don't get something, then I'll say, let's pray for it. Let's wait and see. Let's see what happens. Let's pray for it. I'll pray for it. Hoping to get that. He'd never say something negative. He would just keep it open. Keep open, you know. So that's also very beautiful, because if you're doing this type of work internally, say, toward trying to resolve a painful relationship, trying to resolve a painful relationship, sometimes you can't. You're even sitting in internally and trying to imagine the other person, and the it's so toxic and the hatred is so much that you can't even allow yourself to think kindly about that person or think about what they need, because there's just too much toxicity. Right, so you're not able to do that. But what you are able to do is to make that attempt. That's itself a big thing. to even be willing to make the attempt. Sometimes it's not always successful, but that prayer is there. Because in the end, for a person who's a mamukshu, you know, you're a mamukshu, what is primary for us? This is also, it's so obvious, but it is such a huge realization. And once it's a realization, your life is set. That your life, your sadhana is set. What is primary? What is primary really is that in terms of your moksha liberation is the antakarana shuddhi. That's what's primary. Vairagya. Having a mind that owns its knowledge. You know, a mind that, as Swamiji says, really, but this is what it amounts to, a mind that is big as Ishwara. And what he means by that is that Ishwara accommodates everybody. Ishwara accommodates the entire creation. For Ishwara, there's a place for everyone. You know? Ishwara doesn't kind of get into these interpersonal relationships. I mean, we don't either. Say at this particular moment, there's nobody in this, hopefully there's nobody in this room at this moment that is causing you grief, right? So say, if that's the case, and if it's not, imagine such a situation. Yeah. That's Ishwara. It means that what it means is it's very simple. There's no ahankara coming at the moment. There's no ahankara reverberating off of the situation at the moment, where you need something to be in a different way in order for you to be happy. That's what causes the ahankara to reverberate, you know. This person is stopping me from being happy, or this situation is stopping me from being happy. They're causing me this pain, and why are they doing this to me? How did I ever get myself in this situation? It goes on and on and on. It's the ahankara sprouting off of this situation that is causing me some dukkha, right? So dukkha, that sorrow, sprouts all kinds of things. Now, say in the given moment, there is nothing that is causing that, right? Then the ahankara itself is just absolutely neutral. It's not active. And so in that state, especially for a jnani, somebody who is a mamukshu, at that state, everything is objective. Everything has its place. Right? There's the jiva hasn't entered. So in fact, just in from an ajnani point of view, you don't say you have no knowledge at all. Experientially, we have many, many, many moments where there is no overt jivatvam being experienced because the situation is what it is and there's nobody asking it to be different. The jiva raises its head. I mean, just experientially I'm talking. There's not a cognitive thing going on here. But experientially, so much of the time, this moment is fine as it is. For jnani, as you gain knowledge, more and more moments are fine as they are. And because of that vairagya, because you know the source of your ananda, and so as yourself, and so the mind has a home base, and so that type of that jivatvam isn't being excited anywhere near as often, and it becomes excited less and less and less, and you find yourself more and more and more being able to give others space to be as they are, space to be as they are. You can give people space to be as they are only when you don't need them to be in a particular way to make you happy. If you don't need them to be in a particular way, then you can accommodate them as they are. You know, and if they need your help or they want help or something with something, then you can give that to them. And if they don't want that and need anything from you, you can let them be. It's a non-issue for you. And that gives people a tremendous amount of freedom. So the freedom that you give to others increases and increases and increases as your need for them to be a particular way decreases. And that's the growth that we keep experiencing. But as we go on experiencing that growth, there are still, the laggards inside. The areas that where we don't feel free. Those are the important areas. Those are our sadhana. And really, with each one is a jewel in a way. Each one actually is to be highly valued for the mumukshu. For you as a mumukshu, not for you as a samsari, but for you as a mumukshu, each one of those things is most important for you. Because in fact, every single time you're able to overcome, resolve one of these difficult relationships to the point of freedom, freedom, emotional freedom in reference to that relationship where it doesn't have the power, that power to hurt you, your psyche has become that much stronger. Because it's not only going to be a growth in reference to that person, it's a growth period, right? And so each one of those people in your life, in a sense, is a very painful gift to you. Because it's not easy. It's not easy. But if it were easy, they wouldn't be one of the jewels. The jewels are hard. It's hard. If it's not hard, then it's not a problem. But there are those hard ones. And those are the ones where we do these particular meditations for. And these meditations, like this pratipakshabhavana, that then one phase of it now. I'll do it next week. I'll try to do others. But it's all in light, just a different dimension of what I find Swamiji doing now. Where we moved to with this, it's kind of like what we did last week, but it's taking that whole pratipakshabhavana and then developing it even further by objectifying the whole situation, the two people involved or more, but I'm just using two as an example, and then objectifying it more and more, seeing all the causes, cause effect. I did this with them last week, all the cause effect that's involved, and having created this situation and create the cause effect involved creates the situation, and it creates all of the ahankar, all of the reactions. There's a reason for all of those reactions, like this person behaves this way and I react this way. But there's reasons I react this way. And there's reasons this person reacts that way. So to see, to really understand the complexity of it and understand it as something taking place in Ishwara's order. This dance, complex dance, is being generated as Ishwara. It's being generated as Ishwara's order. And to really understand that and let it be, to appreciate it, let it be. What I mean by that is to appreciate it, to see it, to understand how all of this is happening, how Ishwara is creating all of this, the laws of Ishwara, the order of Ishwara is creating all of this. See it being created and accept it. Don't push it away, just feel it. And then instead of reacting to it, because you're feeling it, objectifying it, understanding, then you can actually take some actions to transform it or change it. And then again, you'll see the domino effect of every action you take. You see, if I behave this way, that generates this slew of feelings and emotions. But if I behave this way, right, then all of these things, are generated. And so there's a certain objectivity and understanding of Ishwara's order, Ishwara's law, and letting yourself be totally present to it and experience it. And then with that kind of karma yoga buddhi, take some actions that are based upon based upon your knowledge, you know. And I mean that not only in terms of just the knowledge of Ishwara and the knowledge of the self. I mean also your practical knowledge. For instance, this, like when we did the Pratipachabhavana, when you see, what does this person need from me for them to feel all right? So I will be able to see what I need from them for me to feel all right. What about when you say, what does this person, their little child, need from me for them to feel all right? And the next question is, can I give that to them? It's an amazing question. Can I do that? Am I able to do it? Am I able to do even a little part of it? That's what Swamiji was telling me about this person. You just go do this little thing. Even he told me, and it was so true, he said, even the smallest, you just make that smallest little step, and it'll change. It'll make things different. It's true. So you say to yourself then, you know, what can I do? And the parts might say, no, I can't do any of it. Not now. That's okay. And say, okay, we'll try tomorrow. Yeah. Or then you can always use, then you could say, you don't think there's even one little tiny thing you can do?
No.
Okay, that's okay. That's the patience. But you know, you've started to learn how to be with your feelings in this kind of way, transformative way. It's a good exercise. And also when you exercise these type of things, you take the step of exercise kind of seriously, you can also modify it in a way, modify it according to your feelings in a way that is transformative for you. Get to start somewhere, this is a good way to start, to try.
How are we supposed to even somewhat accurately determine what another person needs from us?
You can't exactly, but on the other hand, there is this dyad inside. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're working with imagination, okay? And you just see what your imagination says about what that other person needs.
Okay.
And see if it releases you, okay? If it releases you.
I mean, it'll be greatly dependent on a projection of what my own inner child needs, and then
yes,
and everything filtered through my own expectations. And if I were that person,
yeah. But the thing that that's true. But there's a little bit of difference there. Is that when you have all those feelings, that feelings have been generated by that interaction. And so those two parts are internalized in your psyche, okay? Now how it tends to work, even though it is true, it's your internalized imagination of that person. It's the dyad, the imagined dyad, the real imagined dyad, not what you're going to do.
What's a dyad?
Two people involved, like a twosome. Like a triad would be three, a dyad is two.
Okay.
So two are involved here, and those two, the imaginal you and the imaginal other person, are creating this pain. Right? Mm-hmm. Both are involved, and the pain is pretty real. Okay. So now what happens is, as you imagine on this side, you're there manipulating this side of it, the you side of it, and seeing what you need and watching this side release, the feeling release. Then you're on this side of it. Both sides are you, actually, because they're internalized. and seeing what that needs, you know. Now, I find personally more often than not what that person needs, in the internal person, pretty much usually will mirror what that person actually, external person actually needs. But whether that is true or not, you're making an overture of something toward that person of what you think would be a positive thing. You know, it's positive for you and positive for that person.
Generally, would that be love and care that that person wants from you and that you want from that person? That generally be, would it, what's your problem?
You know, I mean, in the end, it all boils down to love and respect.
Love and respect.
People want to be loved, they want to be respected, they want to be valued. I mean, we can go on and on. But then there's going to be, with all these synonyms, you know. But there'll be particular ways that each person wants to be loved and respected. But you'll know inside what it is in that particular dyad between you and that other person, because you're locked into a pain-producing situation. So if you don't feel like what is releasing you internally in terms of what that person needs, if when you're kind of around that person you don't feel that's true, you don't have to say anything, but you can still do this work inside. And then, but you're still doing the work, even if you say, well, what could I do that? And you say, what does that person need? And you're able to kind of imagine it and feel it. Then you say, can I give that? That creates a whole nother something you sit with. But all of it is untying a knot. It shouldn't be tying a knot. It should be untying a knot.
Well, that's for your own mind. I mean, that's what the
because our own mind is carrying the pain, right? Otherwise, a person can act any way, and you don't have to take it on. You know, you can be with that. You can be objective. You know, and try to help. I mean, I've spent years watching Swamiji do this over and over and over again. You know, and he's not doing anything because he hasn't taken it on, and so it's easy for him to kind of whatever. And some of the situations are very, you know, painful, very intense situations. But then he will just be there with it and try to help. He hasn't internalized it, you know. So if you haven't internalized it, there's no problem there. But that's not what happens to us. In the situations where that doesn't happen, that means we internalize it, and then we have that dyad, that relationship. The two people are inside generating the emotion. And they're just inside working it out, generating the painful emotion. It's like a living, you know, toxic relationship that's held inside of you that you feel.
Well, when you're having that kind of reactionary response, you still see that, you don't see that as that's in the natural order, and you don't feel like that you're responsible for generating that. That's Ishwara's generation.
But that's a beautiful thing to be able to actually see all of that, because you can even see the ahankara rising up. You know, now you can see all of the laws in operation. You can see Ishwara in operation. If you can do that, that's actually a beautiful thing. You just see, you see the whole thing. You see the whole thing playing out, and all of the feelings generated, and all of the thoughts and ricocheting around. You know, but you're able to kind of, if you don't run away from that, then you can see all of the cause and effect and everything that's gone into producing this. But if it, that means that you're not pushing it away, and you're not
blaming yourself.
No, you have a certain space there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is really, really useful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you shouldn't be critical for having. I mean, to get that space, you're not critical for having the reactions or the.
No, but you know, if you have a critical mind, that's also one of the things that has a reason for having that critical mind. And so you can even objectify that critical mind. Like you're, if you have a mind that has a tendency to blame you for every little mistake you make, and you know, if you load yourself and feel badly about yourself and all of that, there's a reason. If you objectify that also, that's brought all of that type of painful self-talk about. And that also, there's something that's gone into the creation of that. Within Ishwara, everything's taking place within a very, you know, dynamic and complex order. And like negative self-talk that may be plaguing you didn't just come from nowhere. There's a lot of situations, childhood situations and things that have gone into creating that type of a painful self-talk. And so that also has to be understood as part of Ishwara's order. You know? And then we can work to change it, because within that order, you know, you can manipulate it also. Objectively acting upon it. You know? But the main thing is to get that type of understanding the whole thing as Ishwara. I'm even watching when the ahankara gets ignited by your, really, the ahankara gets ignited by your raga dvesha, by your likes and dislikes. That's what does it. It just brings it up. If the raga dvesha are mitya to you, because as long as you have a body, the prarogga, there'll be raga dvesha, so there's preferences there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're mitya, they don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're going to be happy if this particular raga, you're going to be unhappy if this doesn't happen. That's not true. You have this preference, and if it doesn't happen, you're fine. That's mitya. Then the ahankara is mitya also. It also doesn't, it's like a bird seed, it doesn't cause any problems. It's when the raga dvesha for you has some punch. Like, I really need it to be this way, and having it not be this way really makes me unhappy.
It matters.
It matters. And then that becomes, you know, a place to be with that, to bring my knowledge to that. One thing I think is really, we'll do this later too, but just for a quick overview of it. Say in terms of raga dvesha, it doesn't have to do necessarily with a person. It just has to do with a desire. You want something to be a certain way, and then you feel the tension that comes from that, because now you have to make it be that way, and you really want it to be that way. So you'll start feeling some tension around that desire, fructifying that desire. So one thing you can do is, that's kind of interesting, is, you know, just allow yourself to imagine what exactly how you want it to be. Because you've got this desire that's causing you stress. Right? So just let yourself just close your eyes and just say, okay, what is it that I'm really desiring here? Just let me imagine the perfect situation. And let yourself just imagine that desire. And you'll actually feel the stress go away. Because your mind has imagined the desire, right? And that's what you want. And so, you know, you've imagined it, and the mind is happy because you've imagined it. It's really funny. Yeah, it's amazing. But then, now you do that, now the stress has been relieved for the moment because you've imagined it. That itself is makes you laugh, that you can actually do that, and it relieves the stress. And then you can look, and then now you can say, do I really need this to be happy? After all, the ananda is myself. It doesn't have anything to do with this object. And now you know that clearly, because just by imagining this situation, you've been relieved of the stress, and you feel happy, you're fine. And then you can say, you know, actually, my happiness has absolutely nothing to do with this imagination or with the situation. You see it clearly. And then the raga gets back reduced into nitya.
Mm.
Yeah. It's something just to try. It's fun, actually. It's fun to see. Because in truth, the ananda that you're seeking is your own being. There is no external source of ananda. And that's why these little tricks work. And they work because there was never any ananda, externalized ananda anyway. And so all you're doing is removing the stress from your mind and making it like a clear water bucket so it reflects the sun clearly. That's all you're doing. And it works perfectly. You know? But the thing is, we have to have a few tools, different tools to use, different understandings to use to match the particular situation that we're in, you know, that the mind needs at that time. Mm-hmm. And we do all of this once, you know, once that mumukshu term is strong enough. Where everything has become a sadhana. That's very real. Everything becomes a sadhana. That in any way is not where in any place that I'm not owning my knowledge, that's the sadhana, that's all. And then life is fine. You just do it. Not that it isn't hard.
Yeah. But because there is that innate urge, you may mention this, innate urge to have the mind be like the self, or
the mind. Well, we don't want pain in the mind.
Yeah.
If the pain is mithya, it's not real pain. It can be painful, but there's nothing engaging it. You're not, the ahankara isn't engaging it. It's like driving through a garbage dump. So you don't, after all, we're not asking Ishwara all of a sudden to become like a giant Sukhavritti. I think the whole creation now that we have knowledge, the creation, Bhagavan, should turn into one giant Sukhavritti. That's the only emotion that's available to us now that we have knowledge. Just sukha, 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 sukha. Well, it's not that. That is true for your own swarupa. The ananda of yourself is constant. The creation is multifaceted. And so, that's fine as long as I'm not, as long as it's mithya. And that ahankara isn't generating, you know, a net strangling me.
Sounds good. Not so easy. It's really, I realized when I was sitting down and doing this and trying to follow you, I was watching really my resistance, you know? And I realized, it's like, I think that's a big piece of it. You know, you actually become really aware of the resistance you have to actually letting go of that attachment that keeps you bonded, and because that's, it would be like, oh, great tool, you know, let's go for it. But then there's this internal break.
That's exactly right. And you know, and I told you that story, that when Swamiji had me do that for that one person I was having such trouble with.
Mm-hmm.
At first I couldn't do it. I couldn't make myself do it.
Mm-hmm.
But then finally I did, and then the effect was so dramatic that I then made myself keep trying to do it. And after doing it, honest to God, after doing it like I think three or four, maybe I think three times, it became easy. It's like I developed that strength because I understood the process. And so I was able to do it. And then I was in other situations, I was able to do that. You develop the strength, but first, the resistance is incredible. At least for me, it was.
So it's cracking through that block. I mean, there's a kind of a
yeah, there's a huge block of resistance. Block. It's just you don't want to.
Yeah.
It's just a very strong habit.
I don't know what it is. It's just a great big giant no.
Yeah.
And not
it's a very proactive forgiveness process in a way, which I mean, that's kind of how it feels. So forgiving oneself, forgiving the other one. It's a, you know, it's not like forgiveness just kind of falling out of the sky, but actually you're taking a stand of deconditioning yourself.
Deconditioning just the littlest step, and the the fruit is so great for that little step that you, that it makes you stronger for the next time and then the next time. And then all of a sudden, it, for me, I realized maybe after 6 or 7 times that, that, and which didn't take all that long in a way, it just became something that I did in those situations. It was like something
it became part of you, kind of.
Yeah, something I had available to me to do in those situations, whereas before that wasn't true because of that very strong resistance. But there's nothing like being rewarded for your work. You know, if you do something really hard but there's a reward, then all of a sudden it's not so hard anymore to do it the next time.
It seems to me, you know, it's kind of a surprise in your describing this process, how, like when you describe it in the dyad, really it's you, it's your reaction to another person, and the other person really is, really it's you, it's your imagination of the other person.
That person is what we call an introject.
Yeah.
That other person is really internalized inside of you.
But in the heat of the moment, or in the, when you're going through this feeling of reaction, especially if the person is there, it doesn't seem like it's internalized. It seems like that's the person. It's interesting how...
Oh yeah, that's all the projection. That's amazing.
What's it called?
Projection.
What? No, the introvert?
Introject. That's a psychology term.
Intro?
Introject.
Introject.
It's like, just like you introject your parents when you're little. You internalize them. It's like you, sometimes we say you swallow them whole. And they're living in there, you know. But another thing about that for the psychology people, an introject, like say you internalize a person that you know very well, that you've had a lot of relationship with, a lot of contact. That internalization, especially your, in your psyche, is taking in a huge amount of information into the unconscious. Much more information goes into the unconscious than the conscious mind can assimilate. Mm-hmm. You know. So now, say for an adult, say like for your partner, you didn't know your partner when you were a child. So your partner can get all kinds of projections on them, childhood projections on them. But on another level, you know your partner. You take in day after day after day after day. You take in so much information, so much more than your conscious mind can possibly handle. Right? And so when you're asking, for instance, Say the problem happens to be with your partner or with your, a parent, somebody who you have a, really have taken in tremendous amount of information into the psyche. What that person says to you, say if you ask them or you imagine, what do you need from me? There's probably a lot of truth in it. I wouldn't take it lightly with that. What you're getting from that person. I'm not saying that it's absolutely the truth. I don't mean that, but I wouldn't take it lightly. You know, what they hear, but what they say, it probably has some truth in it.
Oh, how do we experience this unconscious gaining this information? I mean, is that, is there a clue to that?
Well, it's, no, it's just all imaginal. Like, say if I ask you to, like sometimes when I ask you to imagine, what if I ask you again to imagine a meadow, like I do so often?
Yeah.
And
no, I meant if a large percentage of our understanding is unconscious.
Not our understanding, a lot of our experience that flows in is way more than can be registered by the conscious mind. And so it's just there in the unconscious. And what that means is that you can dialogue with that unconscious and get a tremendous amount of wisdom.
Oh, okay.
From it, because,
so that
because
process,
it's taken in so much.
So that process is going on unconsciously.
There's a lot going on in the unconscious that you can learn how to tap into and dialogue with.
Yeah.
that can be very, very helpful and very valuable. Now that's even on another level.
Yeah.
It's like you were going to say, that's where I was laughing, that you were going to, that, you know, somebody says something, and you're actually not even really listening to what they're saying, you're just projecting all your unconscious.
You're unconscious.
So like, you know, they might say something really ordinary and it just triggers some kind of button because it just plugs right into all the unconscious stuff that you just have been piling up, you know.
Well, of course, that's also true, and that's why communication is so difficult, really. Mm-hmm. And even when we're teaching Vedanta,
mm-hmm.
that's why you can't assume, you know, that what you're saying is what the student is hearing. No, but really, I mean, the teaching methodology doesn't assume that every word mm-hmm. really has to be unpacked and unfolded and looked at from all of these different ways. It's no easy task.
Yeah. Well, Swamiji was very careful.
To pass this knowledge, yeah.
Swamiji was very careful about that.
Always.
Mm-hmm.
You know, layer upon layer upon layer of unfoldment. You know, we're as careful as we can be. And then there's always satsang. You know, the student asks a question and then you realize that you were saying it this way
mm-hmm.
and that was giving a completely different understanding. So it gave one understanding to you, it gave another understanding to your student. So you keep going on working through all of this, you know, just for this knowledge to be passed. And the only reason that it can happen at all is because the reality is here. And these words are all poking at it. It's there to be seen, you know. So, but it's a task. Communication is a task.
Yeah.
I saw so many instances, though I can't give you an example at the moment, where Swamiji would have said something many years ago, and then I listened to him, and all of a sudden, oh my gosh, that's what he meant by that.
Mm.
And I never heard it quite that way, and then it just made so much sense. Like, oh, he's been saying that all along. That's what he meant.
Where were you?
But I never heard that particular way he was saying it. I never saw what he was meaning when he was saying it in that way. You know, and then I saw it. It's amazing.
And when you say it, you just say it's so obvious.
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds us how limited our
prayer. I know, let's say it now. If we didn't say our prayer because we never stopped.
I know, we just managed that the right way.
Yeah. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Oh.
You did?
I did.
Okay.
Which is going to help me say that when a person dies,
yeah,
the sukshmi and the manas, which is
part
of sukshmi that does not die, but
right.
And so everything that we talk about, the conscious mind, the unconscious mind, the way all of those workings are part. Is that part of Sukshma Sharia then? No, is there anything, are those the samskaras that we carry
those
on?
Those are the samskaras that we carry on. But
that's
then
like
that
you're born with certain inherent traits.
Mm-hmm. Or tendencies. Easy, the tendency on the subtle body is there. That capacity is there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that capacity is easily triggered. And then I mean, it has to make its grooves in the new brain and everything like that, but the capacity is triggered.
And so really that sort of, you know, karma or whatever, that whatever we work on emotionally, mentally, carries forth to some degree?
Well, to some degree, and it depends upon what are the karmas that are being manifest in this next life, you know, because the karmas are infinite in the sanchitta. So the karmas that are coming into this body have to have something to do with the last life and with the time and space. And, you know, so different capacities that you have to be, there has to be some connection. Just like if you go through this life from birth to death, it's connected. Even though maybe what you're doing when you're 40 is so much different than what you were doing when you were 20 that you could never imagine that you would be in this situation at this time, right? But if you look at the whole thing, there's been a whole everything is connected that got you to here. Mm-hmm. And so say when you move into your next life, there's still a connection. It's a different body. But there's a whole network of connections bringing in karmas from here and there and everywhere. But it has to make sense.
But we don't even know that. That's just one thing we kind of assume or something.
You assume there should not. There, because how are you going to know what those are, even if that's true? It's all, the only thing that's true is because the data say so. You don't have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, but you know, there's something inside of you that has to go along with that. So it makes sense to me, and I accept that, and that's what the data say. It works for me emotionally and intellectually. And
you know the recording? Didn't you say you put the recording up from this person? Not yet, from the person. From the beech tree?
No, I haven't received it yet.
Oh, I see.
It's in the mail.
But the discussion, or I mean the dialogue about that, did you, something...
That I did a dialogue, you mean? Or his dialogue?
Oh, his dialogue?
He talked for an hour.
And that you put up, right?
No, I don't have it.
It's
been mailed to me.
I thought you put something up and I couldn't...
I didn't.
You know, but if you really know that your wholeness or your completeness is not in the creation, you're not going to be traveling anymore. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, because why go on? I mean,
once that's true for you, that's true for you.
Huh?
Yeah, that's
right. Could also be that the last birth can be difficult initially, just to.
They say that, you know, that for a lot of people it's like to get your papas out of the way at the beginning.
And create a moksha.
Yeah, it can. But also, you know, like there's some duritas, you know, negative karmas that sometimes you'll exhaust at the beginning. Sometimes people talk like that. Because then once you meet your teacher, it's a whole different life.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there's the life prior to meeting your teacher and the life afterwards. Because like afterwards, then that mumukshutvam has blossomed, right? Once you meet your teacher and knowledge is starting to take place, now there's the life of samsara and then there's the life of the mumukshu. It's like the samsari life is that's over. It's over because there's another person here who's in operation now.
When is the mumukshu turning into a jignasa exactly? Is there kind of a distinct shift, or is it just fluid shift?
Well, I think that the mumukshu realizes, really, usually through teaching, that moksha takes place through knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So when you realize that moksha takes place through knowledge, then it's not just a desire for liberation, it's a desire for knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Because you realize that the knowledge is the liberation. And so once you recognize that, then you say jignasu instead of mumukshu. I just use mumukshu as kind of a generic term.
Yeah, I got that actually. Yeah. In this context, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Carol, how is the child's mind of Ogyani? Like, that psyche also has, the Swamiji psyche also has the child part in the beast. How is that?
You're as kind to the child as you are to everybody else. That's to understand, really, the jnani, you know, the one who has knowledge, is kind internally and externally. That's the key, really. See, if there's a child inside,
mm-hmm.
and that you discover, then you treat that child with the same love and kindness and...
You know. Does Swamiji think of it the same way? Isn't this more of a Western cycle? That would be, I don't know.
No, because he does this work also. So if you were to ask him about it, this is what he would say.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I don't know if I say, well, what about your inner child? But if I was said something like, if you didn't want to be that personal, I said, you can say, you know, well, imagine if you, for your inner child, is this what you would do? And you would say yes. So whatever is there inside you to be dealt with, I mean, Swamiji is a human being. He's doing heaven and conscious as much as everybody else. He's going to have childhood experiences as much as everybody else. But then the question is, how are you with those? Well, you're a jnani with them. If you're a jnani with them as well as you are with the inside world as well as the outside world. It's not going to be that you don't have an inside world. That's not true.
But the adult in you, the adult part of you, jnani, has knowledge enough to deal with.
Yeah. Even this inner friend, you know, instead of what I just called the inner friend, that's very real, you know. And you don't have to be a great Mahatma to have that orientation toward yourself, the different parts of yourself, to even your conscious mind, to others, you know.
Or even spiritual, just that common sense.
Yeah.
Not just
yeah.
Rational thinking.
That's right. And it makes so much difference just to a person's peace. You don't have to be young for that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to stop. I'm leaving early in the morning.
I still.
Yeah.
Thank you.